the sound of your city. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Welcome back to the Taylor Report. Of course, we're now approaching Christmas, and we're analyzing what's happened over the past year and thinking about this issue. Everybody's thinking, and about Corona-19. I've been telling my friends we should call it, what we're doing, Corona Radio. Where we have, everybody's adapting, of course, to these circumstances. But there's hanging over us is really the ineptitude of our leaders, frankly. We are led by controlled by political leaders who have not shown themselves to be competent. And that's kind of a kind word, that's a neutral word. Actually, they've got their class interests all tangled up. And they're being shown up by countries like Vietnam and China, who, because they have a different, they have a social system that puts people first, they have been more exemplary, strikingly so. And I have an article I want to refer everyone to. I hope people go to thelancet.com and read the account by The Lancet of why the Chinese have been more effective in dealing with this, with the COVID. I mean, it's almost a year, and we're now talking in Ontario about a lockdown. Well, then the virus struck Wuhan, and there was an immediate, complete, planned way of public health way of tackling it, and by doing so early and with vigor and with public cooperation and understanding that it was we like to use the phrase we're all in it together. Well, they said we're all in it together, and then they got it together and they supported each other. And they didn't keep saying, "Oh, when can we just go back to normal?" So long as you have a menace of a virus that you don't have a cure for, you don't get to go back. It's not a question of opinion. It's all up to the virus. This is where we find ourselves, and we should underline this because we're in an embarrassing situation where our leaders are lecturing and trying to prepare, show themselves, frankly, as superior in the old-fashioned colonial racist way. They're superior to other peoples, but particularly to China. And it goes back. And I think it's time to remind everybody how we got in this situation vis-a-vis China and South Asia, Africa, South America. And the most significant, probably, turning point that casts light on the matter is the World War I and the attempt at a peace at the end of it. We've been marking, now, I believe wrongly, the 11th day, the 11th hour, the 11th day, the 11th month, and all that. Well, that was just an armistice. That was not the end of the war. And when the parties came together, who regarded themselves as the victors, France, Great Britain, the U.S., and somewhat Italy, they called them the Big Four, pretty quickly became the Big Three, and at one point it became the Big Two, because in fact, the war is always lied about in terms of who cared about it and who wanted to get involved, who wanted to fight. The British and the French wanted to fight with Germany, and the United States wasn't sure they wanted to do that. And it was a long time for the U.S. coming into the war, and we turned it into kind of a silly kids game of you should have come earlier, we were the ones who did. In fact, political differences are political differences, and they didn't have it all worked out and who was going to do what and in the name of what. So Wilson came to the peace conference, which took them about a year before they could get an agreement, get it signed. And by the time they got that agreement signed, a lot of people had died of all kinds of problems growing out of the war, which was during the time of armistice. They called the armistice. The French military leadership behaved abominably, and they created a lot of bad blood. But because Wilson was wobbling, and eventually he was driven out of office, American people had elected Republicans who didn't agree with what Wilson was doing, and the peace conference basically was his undoing. But China was involved there, and it is a striking fact that when they signed the Versailles Agreement in 1919, China did not sign it. And why not? Well, because Japan had joined the Allies and fought against Germany a little bit. There was some heavy fighting on one occasion. So when they were carving up the world after World War I, Germany had a port in Shandong, what is now Shandong, in China, and they also controlled the territory around. They had captured that actually by force. They had used the old excuse that somebody had killed a white Christian, and therefore the Army, Navy, and the Marines had to land and crush the Chinese who had done that. And they said as a result of coming, the only way they would be satisfied is if China, which was weak and almost on its back, would give them Shandong, give them the port, and give them other economic benefits for a period, guess what, of 100 years. Sort of like Hong Kong, similar story. So Germany had fought Britain in the First World War, and so China said, when they were there, as opposed to Germany, and they said that, of course, the territories that the Germans had taken from them should be returned. But Wilson and the British said no, it should go to Japan. And they gave the German holdings in Shandong to Japan. And as a result, the Chinese representative, a very memorable individual named Wellington Wu, I believe, I'll get his name, but he said, you know, you're trampling on the integrity. Wellington Ku, pardon me, Wellington Ku. He's a Harvard man, by the way. He refused to sign it. So you see the seeds of a problem that the imperialists, frankly, that's who they were. They were great powers. They called themselves the great powers, and other people were lesser people. So they said that Japan would be given what had been Germany's territory in China. So they believed in dividing up the world as pure, as plain as the nose on your face, as they say. I should say that Wellington Ku made a very nice additional point, and I'm looking for the language here to make sure I get it right. But he argued that he said that he called for an end to imperialist institutions such as extraterritoriality, you know, places like Guantanamo, Hong Kong, extraterritoriality and tariff controls and legation guards and lease holds, because these things, you remember, the Hong Kong was leased, and in South America, I mean, the one that really stands out is Guantanamo, which is in Cuba. The lease is up, but the Americans haven't gone. have decided to stay. So this is the kind of issue faced by the world at end of World War One, and this is the kind of the decisions made there created the circumstances for later struggles for national liberation and independence, self-determination, and a struggle against racism. And to illustrate that point, the Japanese representative at the peace talks, but later when they decided to form the League of Nations, which was part and parcel of the peace arrangement. They agreed that they were going to have a League of Nations so as to prevent further wars. Well, the Japanese representative who was there and was paid some respect, he argued that they should there should be in the charter of the League of Nations legal racial equality, and he proposed that that discrimination in among members of the League of Nations, there be no discrimination. That proposal by the Japanese representative to the founding of the League of Nations was turned down by Woodrow Wilson, but the first voice against it was the Australian Prime Minister. And here's his words. His name was Billy Hughes. "No government could live for a day in Australia if it tampered with a white Australia." What he meant by that was, if we treat you as equal, that would mean that, you know, in trade, and that Japanese would have some access, legalized access to Australia. And their Prime Minister, John Curtin, is quoted, and he says that Australia, you have to understand, is an outpost of the British race. The outpost of the British race. So you want to know who the mama and papa of the Five Eyes were? It's very clearly laid out by the people there at the League of Nations, and attempting to form it. Of course, Japan was insulted. Here they were. They said, "Oh, you're our ally, and we leave and give you the." They actually thought they were going to buy their silence in a way by giving them the German lease in China. But it, of course, was humiliating and infuriating, because it was a clear message that they weren't equal. And that message is carried on, unfortunately, today, to the cost of all humanity. It is very dangerous for all of us that this kind of thinking exists. The other element that happened during those meetings that should be called out is that the British and the French, particularly, somewhat the Italians, but the best name, the British and the French, wanted to carve up, and they did carve up, the Ottoman Empire, and they gave each other territory, and USA went along with it. And it was, the way they did it was to say, this will be British mandate territory, and then this other part will be French mandate. And some writers pointed out, analysts at the time, well, what is this word? It isn't, it's a totally made up word. And all it means is, you get that and I get this other thing. And why do we get to have it? We're mandated. Take a look at the territory under dispute called Palestine. That's a mandate, British mandate. Why? Are we going to have a plebiscite of the people there? You know, in Europe, they had a plebiscite. There was Silesia, northern Silesia, where you had German and Polish population. They said, oh, well, you have to have a plebiscite, because, see, these are Europeans. But for Arabs and Africans and Asians, they're under mandate. So that was the ground that they laid. And they put dynamite under their own feet. Of course, what they were looking for under their own feet was oil and minerals, and exploitation of cheap labor. But that was World War I, and that's the way they did it. And it's good for the record that Wellington Koo challenged them. And also, he really deserves all respect in the world for not signing on behalf of China, because he said, you're carving up my country. And we come here as your ally. So anyway, it's a story that needs to be told. We need to come back to this more. And let's just mention about Hong Kong and the Canadian government, the Five Eyes gang and the rest. They love to say there's authoritarian rule in Hong Kong. Well, they would know about that, because they had 152 years of British authoritarian rule, and it can't be defined any other way. There were no Chinese governor generals. They were all British. And there was also emergency laws to take people off the street anytime there were too many of them gathering, or if they growled, or if they didn't show respect for the British flag. There were plenty of British soldiers and others that from the empire. They used to use one portion of the empire to beat up on the other portion, which is an art form in imperialist politics, and you have to just recognize it. And again, it should be repeated. That's the reality. There is no basis for Canada and the U.S. or any of these others to talk about how they care about the people of Hong Kong. They had 152 years to care. And then in 152 years, they didn't think it was important to establish it, but they wanted their form of democracy. They don't even, in fact, they didn't, you know, they even played with the citizenship game. They never, if you were in Hong Kong, you could call yourself British, but you can't go to Britain. And lately they thought, well, maybe we'll change that. Because what? Because they can make some problems with China. They think they're not going to succeed. This is, and I love our global affairs minister. He says, oh, the world is watching. Well, if they are, they're laughing at you. Because we've gone through a period of colonization and decolonization. And when you say the world, tremendous number, I can't tell you the exact number, of members of the United Nations who were previously colonized. So when you come to them with crocodile tears and say, oh, somebody in my former colony is calling me bad names, they all go and excuse themselves and laugh in the hallway, because you deserve it. So this is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. The Lancet, very recently, here's the opening paragraph. While the world is struggling to control COVID-19, China has managed to control the pandemic rapidly and effectively. And how is that possible? And he outlines that some of the ways that this occurred, characterizing the views of Donald Trump, calling to call it coronavirus. I want to get to the core of this. According to a July survey by Pew Research Center, two-thirds of Americans believe that China has done a bad job dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. It is clearly not an opinion shared by the World Health Organization. In a press conference in September, Mike Ryan, executive director of the World Health Organization Emergencies Program, offered, quotes, deepest congratulations to the frontline health workers in China and the population who worked together tirelessly to bring the disease to this very low level, as it is now understood that China has only cases in the tens. And most of them come from outside, but they're still extremely vigilant, taking care of it. As of October 4, 2020, China has confirmed 90,604 cases of COVID and 4,739 deaths, while the U.S. has registered 7,382,194 cases and 209,382 deaths. That's October. As you know, we're now at 300,000. Despite being the first place to be hit by COVID, China was well placed to tackle the disease. It has a centralized epidemic response system. Most Chinese adults remember SARS-CoV and the high mortality rate that was associated with it. The society was very alert as to what can happen, said the professor at Yale School of Public Health. Other countries do not have such fresh memories of a pandemic. And here's an interesting point. Aging parents tend to live with their children or alone, but nearby, only 3% of China's elderly population live in care homes, whereas in several Western countries, such facilities have been major sources of infection. That's rather interesting, by the way. That speaks to culture and civilization, I have to say. The speed of China's response was the crucial factor. They moved very quickly to stop transmission. Other countries, even though they had much longer time to prepare, delayed their response. And that meant they lost control. That's Mayo Institute. The first reported cases of the disease that came to be known as COVID occurred in Wuhan, and they began enacting rigorous countermeasures later the same month. Well, I'm going on here. I think you got the point. This is the Taylor Report. I refer you, go to the Lancet.com. Lancet's one of the most highly respected medical journals. And you won't see it quoted in the Globe and Mail and Toronto Star, because they have committed themselves to a campaign of hatred, and also to tell Canadian people that we are in an adversarial relationship to China, which is a lie. We are not in an adversarial relationship, and we need to change course. This is Taylor Report. See you next week.